Hi, welcome to NanoNewton, podcast discussions with scientists and MIT students in the field of nanomechanics. And this is in conjunction with the undergraduate MIT Engineering course 3052, Nanomechanics of Materials and Biomaterials. I'm your host, Christine Ortiz, Associate Professor in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering. And today's topic of discussion is elasticity of fibronectin fibrils. And we have two guest participants today from Duke University by phone, Professor Stefan Zauscher and Yi Lam, who is a graduate student at Duke and who is also a former student at MIT. So I'll start by introducing Professor Zauscher, and then we'll go around the room and introduce all the rest of the podcasters, and they can introduce themselves as well as Yi Lam. So Professor Zauscher is in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and Materials Science at Duke University and received his Master's in Materials Science from Oregon State University and his PhD in Materials Science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Zauscher's research is concerned with a number of different areas: the mechanical properties of single macromolecules and protein ligand systems, functionalization of surfaces with polymers and biomacromolecules with nanometer resolution, and the mechanics and tribology of stimulus-responsive polymer brushes and cartilage. A large part of the research of his research program is aimed at the design and modification of nanopatterned surfaces that promote or inhibit specific interactions with proteins and cells, and the design of surfaces decorated with bio-inspired polymers for actuation and sensing applications. Dr. Zauscher's research has been published in JAX, Nanoletters, Chemistry of Materials, and Langmuir, and he is the recipient of the Oak Ridge Associated University's Faculty Enhancement Award in Engineering and the National Science Foundation Faculty Early Career Development Award. So, Stefan, can you say hello so everyone can recognize your voice?
Sure. Hello, everyone.
And thank you for joining us today. So we have a number of podcasters here, and we'll go around. First, I think we can start with Yi Lam, who's a graduate student in Professor Zauscher's group at Duke, and also a former MIT student who happened to take this class while she was in course three. And what year was that, Yi?
Just a little while ago.
It seemed like a long time ago. I thought it was like 2000.
Yeah, it was like 2000.
Yeah. Okay, so that's actually 7 years ago. So, Yi, could you give a little bit of your background?
Okay, so I'm currently that means I've been here for 4.5 years as a graduate student at Duke working in Dr. Zauscher's lab. And my current work is focused on looking at interactions between human antibodies and HIV envelope proteins. And so I'm also using the atomic force microscope to pull on molecules, but in a slightly different way and for slightly different reasons. So I've worked with some of the people who are involved in the paper that we're going to be talking about today, and a little bit of background on some of the basics of what's going on.
Great. Thank you very much. And we'll move to Laura Dyer.
Hi, I'm Laura Daher, senior in chemistry, and I'm Europeing for Professor Ortiz and Professor Grudzinski.
Thank you. And Mike Vasquez?
Okay, hello, I'm Mike Vasquez. I'm a junior here at MIT in materials, in the material science department, and I will actually be taking 3052 next semester.
So you'll be ahead.
Yeah.
And what are you doing here over IEP? So for those of you who are listening from outside of MIT, IAP is our independent activities period where we have January off and students can do a variety of different activities during this time. So why don't you tell our listeners what you've been involved in?
So here at MIT, I'm involved in the Center for Sports Research and Innovation. And this January, I'm doing some research on baseball padding equipment and different shoe paddings. So.
Okay, and we'll move to Ben.
My name is Benjamin Brouet. I'm a fifth-year grad student in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering, and I work in Christine Nortiz's lab. My thesis deals with the relationship between the multiscale structure and the mechanical properties of highly mineralized biomaterials such as seashells or enamel.
And what are you doing over IEP, Ben?
You know, working on my thesis, mostly.
Okay. All right. So today we're going to be discussing a recent paper by Professor Zauscher, and the title is Understanding the Elasticity of Fibronectin Fibrils, Unfolding Strengths of FN3 and GFP Domains Measured by Single Molecule Force Spectroscopy. And this paper was published in Matrix Biology 2006, volume 25, page 175. Okay, so maybe, Stefan, you can just go through the author list and tell us who the authors were and what was their contributions to the paper.
Okay. If you look at the author and also the affiliations, you see that it's a collaboration. And the first author, Nehal Abulail, was a postdoc in my group. She is now a professor at Washington State University in Pullman. And she did basically all the atomic force microscopy, spectroscopy in this paper. And Tomo Ohashi is a postdoc and research scientist who works together with Harold Erickson, here at Duke University, in the Department of Cell Biology. And Harold is clearly the person who sort of instigated this whole research because he is possibly sort of the world specialist on, at least in terms of longevity of his research, on fibronectin. And so Tomo works with Harold, and Tomo has basically built all the constructs which we used in this research.
I see.
And Rob Clark is our dean of research here at Duke in the Pratt School of Engineering and a colleague of mine in the department, but he's also the director of the Center for Bio-Inspired Materials and Material Systems. And Rob came to the table here in basically helping and facilitating the measurements from a basically engineering standpoint and also an analytic standpoint in terms of the rate dependence of the forces and so on.
Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that the dean can still do some research these days.
Yep.
That's great. So a number of the podcasts that we've had also have this similar trend of having a variety of different departments and centers involved. And so this seems like a very interdisciplinary paper that you've written. Do you want to comment on that?
I guess I can. I did not come to this from a standpoint of basically being really interested in fibronectin. It was basically Harold who said, you know, this is something which we are really interested in. And it's an interesting sort of premise because it seems like this is, at least for us, how research is going a lot of the times, that we talk to biologists or to biochemists who say, you know, we have a very interesting system here, and we really would like to know how things work, and in our case, work mechanically. Mm-hmm. And so Harold approached us and thought that it would actually be very interesting to resolve or at least add to the puzzle about understanding the elasticity of fibronectin, because there seems to be a split in terms of the opinion on how it actually performs under an applied stress. And one of the issues is that Harold seems to propose that it is not an unfolding of individual modules in fibronectin, but rather a global disentanglement of a dimer, whereas other research shows that the unfolding of modules, which has been really nicely demonstrated in the first sort of single molecule experiments by mechanics, that the unfolding basically leads to an elongation, and that may be the main mechanism for fibronectin extension.
Right. So this seems like a very interesting concept that engineering can come into an existing kind of debate in another field and kind of shed light onto what would be more probable.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was sort of our premise, which we worked on, and I guess to some extent I have to admit that maybe we were biased by some of the views from Harold.
Uh-huh.
We took that as the working hypothesis and tried to see can we prove it or disprove it.
Right.
And
okay.
And I guess what we show in the paper that the domain unfolding certainly will play a role, but that this other mechanism can't be excluded, at least.
Okay. All right. Why don't we just start from the basics, and I've kind of have a list of kind of terms that maybe you can define for our students before we start discussing, going through the paper and discussing the data. So maybe either you or Yi could define for us what actually fibronectin is, what are fibrils, what's a recombinant protein, GFP, FN, fibronectin 3, and then single molecule force spectroscopy.
Okay. I don't know you. What do you want to do? Do you know anything about fibronectin?
It's a protein that is, I guess, binds in some ways to some cellular proteins and has a part in the extracellular matrix, which is sort of the support structure for cells to kind of live on in a lot of tissue. And so it's a protein very important in the cell's interaction with this matrix that it lives on, basically. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the actual aspects that are important in this.
Okay,
part.
No, I think... hang on, I wrote some stuff down here.
Okay.
That I would not... it's basically exists in two main forms, either as an insoluble glycoprotein dimer linker in extracellular matrix, but also as a soluble disulfide-linked dimer in plasma. Mm-hmm. So it occurs also in plasma. And it's clearly an important cell adhesion molecule because it can anchor to cells and to collagen and proteoglycan with specific groups along the length of the macromolecule. It's actually a very large molecule. Mm. And it can organize cellular binding, specifically, as Yi already said, binding to membrane-bound receptors, and that happens actually on FN310, that's sort of the tenth module in the FN3 module. And it's generally a rod-like structure, which is composed of three different types of homologous repeating modules, and that's why we have sort of this notation of FN1, FN2, and in this paper specifically FN3.
And so the superscripts that you use in the notation, what do those correspond to?
The superscripts correspond to the basically exact module which we are talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's – or the exact domain – not module, the exact domain which we are talking about. So domain 1, 2, 3, or whatever this number is.
And what is the difference between those domains?
And these domains are – okay – they have slightly different, so the differences between type 1, type 2, and type 3 fibronectin are fairly large. Mm-hmm. They are all homologous, but they have very different sort of local structures and also different extents and different percentages in the overall fibronectin molecule. By far, the most common is FN3. Now, in each domain, again, each domain is slightly different also in the amino acid composition. Generally, they are all characterized by a seven-stranded beta sandwich tertiary structure. So they basically form these modules or these folded up protein structures, which can, upon application of force, sort of pop apart. Mm-hmm. And basically, the unfolding strength for these different domains is also slightly different.
Okay, so this is basically a modular structure in which domains are covalently attached linearly in series?
That's right.
That's correct? Okay.
And then basically through hydrogen bonds in this particular beta sandwich tertiary structure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
And if you break the hydrogen bonds by, for example, application of external force, then you get sort of a catastrophic unfolding, if you like, into an extended form.
Okay, great.
In each of these domains.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about GFP and what that is, and why you chose that, and how you made the construct with that.
Okay, now I have to sort of clearly admit that my limit here in biochemistry. These were clearly all made by Harold and by Tomo. And the reason why there's GFP in there, and that's why this paper was also interesting, because for a while we had thought that we were the first to measure, actually, the unfolding strengths of GFP, which has, at that point when we started this, not been done. But in the meantime, actually, Dietz and Reif had presented a nice paper which actually looked at this. But anyway, GFP is a fluorescence protein, and it's used in its sort of variants as yellow or, what's the other color?
Cyan,
for FRET. And FRET is basically a technique, fluorescence resonance energy transfer, which you can use to study locally basically dynamic processes in biomolecules, for example. You can basically look at changes in the fluorescence behavior as a function of distance between donors and acceptors of radiation, basically, or of energy. Mm-hmm. And these components in GFP are basically, these donor and acceptor are basically the yellow and the cyan.
And was there any particular reason you for the location that you chose where you embedded the GFP?
That's a good question, and mm-hmm. If I remember this right, I think this was sort of the only place where the whole construct was, we were able, or Tomo was able to express this whole construct stably.
Mm, so that was a biochemistry issue.
It was a biochemistry. It was not a logical issue, I think, in terms of where to place this, because it wouldn't have been our choice to put it there for single molecule force spectroscopy, because it was very close to one of the ends of the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
And since we don't really know which side we pick up, basically we reduced our probability of actually including that domain in the, or the GFP molecule in the actual pulling experiment.
Right.
But there was no other choice. They couldn't make it in any other place.
Okay. All right. So Professor Zauscher's paper actually goes on to measure the single molecule elastic properties of these constructs that we've described of fibronectin and GFP. Maybe, Stefan, you can just explain to us in general a little about how you first got interested in this area of single molecule force spectroscopy.
Okay. I guess this goes back to when I was a grad student, and I haven't done this then. I basically worked on surface forces, and I was very fascinated that AFMs could measure surface forces. And at that time, there were the first papers coming out on single-molecule force spectroscopy, using an AFM, pick up a molecule, pull on it, and then basically learn something about its elasticity, and I thought that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then when I came to Duke, I basically started a collaboration with Tosh Chilcoty, who is also making bioengineered polyproteins, so-called elastin-like polypeptides. And since that time, we basically worked on single-molecule experiments on those rather interesting molecules.
So you started with single-molecule force spectroscopy when you went to Duke?
Well, we started, I think, in the second year here. I'm not quite away.
Okay.
And sort of, I guess I came to it also somewhat cold because I hadn't done it before.
Uh-huh.
And then there was also an interest in working with Rob Clark, who since then now has actually really developed very nice, basically, software platforms and also machine platforms for doing single-molecule experiments. And that was sort of another common interest in this area. And so I guess that's how we got started.
Mm, that's kind of similar to my experience. I did my postdoc in the Netherlands. I guess that was in 1999, and I had read papers in the literature, briefs, papers that had come out, just, you know, the first ones that had come out, and actually just wrote a short NSF proposal and went to Holland for a year and did, you know, a few of those types of experiments. So my story is quite similar to yours.
Yeah. And I mean, we have in our department actually probably one of the world leaders in this area, which is, his name is Piotr Marslik.
Mm, yes. I didn't realize that. Yeah.
And I mean, that's what he does sort of every day and quite beautifully.
Right.
And he's looking at also elastic molecules, clearly, but also at DNA and some other things. So.
All right. So I guess Ben has wanted to ask a question then.
Okay, so I have a very basic question, actually. Why is the, you know, knowing which of the two mechanisms is the right one, the one happening, why is that so important? And why is, you know, knowing how the molecules, the proteins deform the elastic mode that they use, why is that so important?
Okay. I guess I hope I can answer this in a reasonable way. I mean, for one, if there's a controversy about a mechanism in biology, I would argue, then, you know, it's worthwhile if it's really something which seems to be important, and we'll get to that, it's worthwhile to find out what's the right one. And so that was a motivation. Well, why is it important? Because I think this was one of the first molecules where sort of people have really realized that force plays an important role for biomechanical function on the sort of nanometer length scale. And then there was this interesting phenomenon that if you pulled on these things, that they basically modularly unfolded. They gave these sawtooth patterns. So then it was postulated, well, maybe this may be necessary for its function in vivo, where there are actually fairly large strains. And so how would the molecule, and I think one has to sort of be careful here, and we have to be careful in this paper also, that we are really not looking at a single molecule in vivo, but we are looking at fibril bundles. But essentially, what's happening in these fibril bundles? I mean, are domains unfolding when you pull on this thing, or is this whole construct, this whole fibril essentially sort of just unfolding, disentangling? And then that leads to elongation.
So does fibronectin, is it known to play a mechanical role in the ECM?
Well, that's a good question, and I guess I have to plead my ignorance. I mean, it's important in the sense that it's basically connecting things. It connects cells to other structures in the cell environment. So in that sense, yes, it has an important role. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also another role of ECM in basically fibril formation in, I guess, embryogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
But don't quote me on that, whether that's right. I think so. There are some issues where mechanical force is rather important.
Professor Zauscher, are there any diseases that you know of that where maybe defective fibronectin plays a role?
That's a good question, and I guess I would have to defer to Harold. No, I am not sure. I mean, clearly, if binding, cell binding or cell adhesion is compromised somehow, if, for example, the receptor sites, if the RGD on module 10 is not correctly formed, then you can't get binding to integrin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether that would be a disease which may actually exist or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there are diseases, but I don't know.
And another question, is there any use in tissue engineering, like constructing matrices for cell culture and such? Is fibronectin used at all in tissue culture?
Good question. I could imagine it is, but I don't know also.
I think they've done studies where they use the RGD, the peptide, not necessarily a whole fibronectin construct, but just certain aspects that are particularly important for cell adhesion, like creating collagen matrices with RGD peptides embedded in it to interact with the integrin in cell membranes, and so that will help the cells adhere. But I don't know, really know details about that.
Professor Zauscher, you said earlier that in I have a question regarding the experimental conditions versus the conditions in vivo. You said that in vivo the molecules are in bundle. I suppose it's more like a network. How do you know that when you're picking up one of those molecules during your experiments, you're picking only one of them, or you know you may be stretching a couple of proteins attached to each other, and you know, would that affect the forces you measure, or what are your assumptions?
That's an excellent question. So, I mean, it's actually two. So one is, yes, in vivo, there are not single fibronectin molecules, which are sort of interesting. These are usually in bundles, in fibrils. They form essentially a matrix structure, or can form a matrix structure. So when we do the experiments, we are sort of paring it down to the minimum, which is a single molecule. And then you ask, how do you know that you have a single molecule? And I guess that's one of the critical questions in all of these experiments. For one is that you seed them onto the substrate at very low densities, grafting densities, if you like, so that the probability of picking up a molecule is actually very low.
And just if I may ask, how do you check that, you know, density is actually very low? Do
you? Okay. I mean, you can check it just simply by the probability of picking one up. I mean, if you have to really search till you get a binding event, and then when you pull back, you get one of these characteristic curves. Well, if that doesn't happen very often, you could argue that is already a reasonable indication that you may have one. But a better thing to do, in fact, is since these molecules, once they are sort of fully stretched, behave like a freely jointed chain or a worm-like chain. So they follow basically a simple polymer elasticity law. And what you could do, if you're not sure, there are other ways actually of checking things, but if you're not sure, you could take a force which is common to all of the events which you measured, and you normalize by the contour length of the molecule. And if you do that, then they should all superimpose onto one master curve, because they follow essentially the same law of elasticity. And if you had two in parallel which you pulled, it would immediately stick out because you couldn't normalize it that way. Mm-hmm. So that's another check whether you have a single one. The next one is just simply if you have a lot of junk going on when you initially start pulling back, you can say, well, gee, this thing which you're pulling out may have been entangled with others. So you see basically very large non-specific interactions at very small separation distances. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, if you get something where you get, like, I should say double peaks, not these modules unfolding, but basically very long extensions, then you could argue maybe you had two molecules which were sort of entangled and you sort of pulled two in series or something like that. So if the contour lengths don't match.
Okay, so I'm just going to just back up just a little bit, and then maybe we can go to figure one and talk about that in detail. So I'll just describe a little bit of the experiment. I think you described it as well. So you are adsorbing these fibronectin molecules to surfaces, or is it a covalent attachment?
I think in this case we adsorb them, yes.
Okay, so you're absorbing them, and then you're doing an atomic force microscopy experiment with a silicon nitride tip or a silicon tip?
I think these were silicon nitride.
Silicon nitride.
And I would have to just briefly go back. I think it's just simple silicon nitride.
Okay. And then doing a high-resolution force spectroscopy experiment where the probe tip is approaching to the surface and then retracting away from the surface, and I will be going over this in the lecture, and then pulling polymer chains from the surface. And so now we can just move to figure one in the data, so maybe you can... you can explain the data in figure one.
Okay. So if you look at figure one, the first thing, if you look at A, B, C, and D, you see different labels, like 103 nanometers per second up to 1745. That just means the speed at which we pulled on this molecule, okay, because speed matters. So choose figure 1A. What you see is, you see a typical experimental trace. At zero, we have sort of constant compliance contact. It means that the tip is in contact with the surface. And then we start pulling back. And what you then see is when you pull back that essentially the cantilever deflects, leading, which you can calculate into a force or convert into a force. So you see then force plotted as a function of separation here. And you see initially there's a small sort of peak at about 25 nanometers or so that might be unspecific adhesion when you start pulling segments of the protein off the surface or so. And then you see sort of an upward trend and then sort of a sudden sort of collapse down to about zero force. That's basically when we started, when we claim we unfolded one of the domains in this molecule which we are stretching. But then after this catastrophic event, essentially, we start pulling again, so the force increases till the force is large enough that the next domain unfolds. And that's not necessarily the neighboring domain, but anywhere along the length in this molecule. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to us because, in fact, what we want to know is which one does unfold first. Is it the GFP or is it the fibronectin? That was one of the questions which we wanted to ask.
Right. So how are you interpreting this data in terms of how are you assigning peaks to GFP versus fibronectin?
That's a good question. And I guess one of the things is that we know the amino acid composition very well of both molecules. Mm-hmm. So we can calculate essentially the fully extended length of either of these two domains. And we are lucky in that sense that basically the GFP is about three times as large or as long as the fibronectin. So that is one criterion. But that gets a little bit muddled by the fact that these domains not always unfold like in a go-no-go situation. There are also partly or partially unfolded domains there. Mm. That means that you apply a force and they unfold a little bit, and that's it. So basically we set up a criterion that anything which is sort of below about 35 nanometers was, and which looked like a forced unfolding, was basically attributed to fibronectin, and all the others, all the other peaks were attributed to GFP.
Professor Zauscher, regarding figure 1B, what happens for the last peak? You see that very high peak that goes up to 800 piconewtons, and then there is a sharp drop. Did you detach the molecule, break it? Can you know what happens for that very last peak?
Okay, so yes, potentially in this last peak there, the molecule may have completely detached, yes. So you pulled and you pulled and pulled, and it basically, let's say, all the modules unfolded, and then you have to apply 800 piconewtons, which is a reasonably large force, and then the molecule just basically dissociates either from the substrate or from the tip. And in this particular case, you see sort of this, it's not a sharp peak, it has sort of a plateau up there. It may just mean that basically it hasn't really detached sort of completely right away, but there was sort of a loop or something like that might have detached, and then it finally fell off completely.
And since you, for that same curve, you apparently there are only three of the domains that unfolded. Does that mean that you picked the molecule, the protein in the middle of it? You see what I mean?
That's right. You can sort of then start guessing of where you may have picked this molecule. That's correct, yes.
Okay.
And you never really know where you pick it. I mean, the probability that you pick it right on the ends is lower than if you pick it anywhere somewhere in the middle. So.
And it also can be absorbed to the surface anywhere along its length.
Mm-hmm.
Extra variability.
Professor Zauscher,
mm-hmm.
Did you ever use modeling to kind of predict what you might see in a curve when you pull on your molecule?
That's a good question. No, we did not. There are very nice experiments by the Klaus Schulten group and also by others now, but with steered molecular dynamic simulations, which actually predicted a lot of the modular unfolding of these beta sheet sandwich proteins. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the information which we have on IG and FN proteins was actually validated, if you like, or substantiated by these simulations.
Mm-hmm.
But we did not use this technique.
What are the difficulties in comparing molecular dynamics to single molecule force spectroscopy by AFM? They're quite different rates, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, one is enormous. The simulations are just in order for the computations to work out extremely fast.
Right.
So the forces are all skewed to larger or higher values.
Higher values, yeah.
And I guess I'm not a specialist in MD simulations, but I mean, you can make then again, you sort of can extrapolate it down to the rates at which you did the experiment, mm-hmm. and you can compare. So,
yeah, I think you have to make the assumption that the unbinding or the interaction or the extension pathway is the same at higher forces as it is at lower forces, so that it's the sort of same energy barrier that you're crossing at low and high forces,
mm-hmm.
With the different rates that you pull.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we go to figure 2, this is I'm assuming this is the analysis of the data from figure 1, where figure 1 are typical examples and figure 2 includes the full data set?
Exactly.
Right. And so you see this very interesting kind of bimodal distribution, and you've separated them out into different classes. So maybe you can comment on that?
Okay, so as Christine said, you can see basically these two distributions, one which goes to a little bit above 30 nanometers in length, and then the other which starts at 40 and goes to 80. So these are the two classes of molecules, we think. One is fibronectin, that's the left one, or the basically 10 or 0 to 35, and the GFP is the 40 to 80. But then you see then there's also differentiations in there. A fully extended domain of fibronectin is on the order of 28 or 30 nanometers, roughly in that order. And so what you see here is that that was not necessarily where most of the unfolded length lay, so they were smaller than that. And that suggests that we had partly or partially unfolded domains. And that's quite reasonable. I mean, if you look in the literature by Oberhauser and by Reef and so on, I mean, this partial unfolding is observed very often. Mm-hmm. And the same happens, turns out, also for GFP, where we think have partially unfolded GFP. Mm-hmm. The fully extended length for GFP domain is on the order of also about 80 nanometers, 75 or 80.
Is there any interest in understanding the elasticity of GFP itself?
Well, I guess I guess there is. I mean, there's a paper out in PNAS just on the elasticity of GFP. And I think it is interesting because it's used so commonly in biochemistry as basically a spliced in domain for doing basically all the FRET work that, you know, is particularly if you're interested in mechanics, then it's rather interesting to know what is GFP actually doing when you apply a force. So for that reason, yes.
I have a quick question. A lot of effort was spent measuring the rate dependence, as in Figure 1, and why is this important for the work that you guys did?
Well, I think it's actually critically important, and I have to say that we were not even able to resolve all of the problems associated with this, but that's more a limitation of the AFM than anything else. Mm-hmm. If you think about, I think somewhere in the paper it says what a typical sort of strain rate in vivo is. It's on the order of, I think, 4 microns per minute or something like that. That comes out to about 2 nanometers per second in pulling speed.
Do you know where that is in the paper?
Page 178, section 2.4. It's in the end of the first paragraph of section.
Yes, right here.
Okay, great. So you're saying physiological rates then are actually around 2 nanometers per second?
That's right.
Okay. And if we go to your experimental rates, okay, so I see in figure 3 that the lowest one you're doing is 50 nanometers per second.
That's correct. Right?
Okay, so you're one order of magnitude.
Different.
Right, difference.
And that's a fairly large difference already. And so the issue is that if you pull on a molecule at a higher rate, then as Yi already said, you might actually explore a different unfolding pathway. It might just basically follow a different unfolding pathway. Mm-hmm. And also the forces required for unfolding are generally higher. Mm-hmm. So it's, I mean, I think in the simplest way to understand it is if you think about silly putty, if you pull just slowly on it, it just flows apart like molasses on the very low applied force, but you give it enough time to do that. And basically like any viscoelastic material, if you pull on it hard, then you have to overcome actually a fairly large, or you have to apply a very large force when it snaps elastically. But so essentially a similar thing happens here, that if you pull basically with a high speed, you have to apply a higher force. And so the question then becomes, what are the forces which are relevant in vivo? I mean, they may not be the 120 piconewtons or so which we observe when we do these experiments, but they may actually be a lot lower. And it may already lead then to an unfolding.
So why did you choose such high rates resulting in higher forces than what you see in vivo? What are the reasons behind this?
Okay, I mean, generally what you're trying to do is if you try to span sort of a range of rates, and the one reason we did that is to see whether there is a change in mechanism. And you could see this in figure 4, where you basically see unfolding strings as a function of pulling rate, log pulling rate. And essentially, at least with the resolution we have here, these are straight lines. Mm-hmm. And but if the mechanism of unfolding, or the unfolding pathway would have changed, you would have seen a kink in this curve. And so what this linear behavior sort of suggested to us, and that's basically where we have to really make a big leap here, we said, well, this, over the range we could test this, there's no change seemingly in the mechanism. So maybe it's reasonable to extrapolate that mechanism down to essentially zero rate.
I see.
Or a rate which compares to those which we would find in vivo.
And, but you didn't try it directly. Was that because of you know, instrument limitations?
That's right. I mean, think about 2 nanometers per second, okay? So, I mean, you have a lot of thermal noise going on in this instrument and drift, I mean, mechanically drift and so on. Essentially, you can't do the experiment that slowly and still expect that you get good force and distance resolution. Mm. So there's just simply a mechanical limit to the instrumental technique.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that the development of new instrumentation to go at these slow rates would be beneficial to the field?
I think it would be because, I mean, if you use it for exploring biology, then you would argue, yes, what you need is low forces and slow speeds.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, low forces, people are making progress. But I think essentially a different technique comes in, and that might be the laser tweezers mm-hmm. technique, mm-hmm. which can go to much lower forces.
Okay, so why don't we now go to the mechanisms, and we can go to figure 6. So you did describe for us briefly the two different mechanisms that people have hypothesized in the literature. So could you explain how the results that we described, where you see this nice unfolding of the individual domains, shed some light on the mechanisms?
Okay, so I guess the argument there is one that, and it goes all back to an experiment which Harold had done, on a fibril using basically GFP or this fret pair, and he could show that even when the fibril was extended 4 times its length, the fret signal or the fluorescent signal didn't diminish. And that suggested that essentially the GFP basically did not, or the fret pair did not wander apart. So basically, there was no breaking of the GFP molecule. And that suggested that that was sort of the initial sort of point of entry for us, that we asked, what is the strength of breaking GFP? Mm. Because if that strength is much larger than that of breaking a fibronectin domain, well, then we couldn't really say much. Because what might have happened is that all the fibronectin might have unfolded by modular unfolding, and the GFP just stayed happily, basically bound in a folded conformation. But if we would have found, or if we find that GFP unfolds at a lower force than the fibronectin, then that clearly would have supported a mechanism which excludes domain unfolding in the fibronectin, because the GFP would have been basically the fluorescence would have been lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Harold found was that the fluorescence doesn't diminish even when the molecule is stretched. So basically we tried to figure out at what force compared to fibronectin does GFP break. And what we found essentially in all of this is that it's just about a little bit less or the same as the average fibronectin force for unfolding. So with that, we then concluded or suggested or we argued that, sure, there may be some domain unfolding going on, particularly because, for example, domain 10 is one which is particularly weak. So that might have unfolded, but there are not that many domain 10s in the molecule, so that it could account that just that unfolding of that single domain or maybe another one could not account for a 4-time stretch.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to come to the conclusion that it's quite reasonable that this mechanism, this alternate mechanism, basically from the extended conformation to the compact conformation, is the way by which or from the compact to the extended conformation is the mechanism by which fibronectin may unfold in fibrils. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly not conclusive, but I think it adds some strength to that argument.
And that compact conformation, the proposed one, is in figure 6C?
That's right, 6C, that's right. And that's based on one of Harold's sort of studies of how this could come about. And he also has some nice TEMs, actually, of this. That, I mean, this is not an unreasonable structure in which fibronectin could sort of coil up.
Mm-hmm. And so essentially you extracted the strength of the domains from your data to come with this interpretation rather than the actual form of the elasticity of the curves.
That's right.
Right.
Exactly.
So did the forms of the elasticity of the curves, like the persistence length you would extract or things like that, is that of interest as well?
Well, I mean, for a while we thought, well, maybe for GFP it might be interesting. Mm-hmm. But then basically Dietz and Reeves' paper came out where they've done specifically that for GFP. Uh-huh. So I guess in our case we didn't really pay much more attention to fitting this and
right.
getting that parameter out.
Okay. It was kind of like affirmation to know for sure that what you were getting was the established pattern for fibronectin or
that's right.
GFP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so how do you think the mechanical properties of the fibronectin would change depending on which mechanism you have? Like, why would nature design this mechanism? Like, what would be unique about the elasticity of this mechanism as opposed to the domain unfolding mechanism?
That's a very good question. And I guess I'm not a fibronectin specialist, but I mean, from my, I would rather more say gut feeling, I mean, domain unfolding is a pretty complicated thing. Mm-hmm. Also, they refold completely if you give it enough time. So that's good. But, I mean, it's a rather complicated mechanism. I mean, if you just think about that a molecule can just simply uncoil, that's somewhat more simple and potentially also more satisfying than sort of an emergency modular unfolding, which may happen at sort of very large extension of the molecule.
Less catastrophic.
It's less catastrophic. But on the other hand, maybe it's actually very important that maybe for particular domains on fibronectin that it unfolds so that basically binding sites are exposed and basically cell adhesion, for example, can happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the actual schematic, you could even imagine that there would be a two-stage kind of hierarchical mechanical design into it. You know, one with a compact conformation at one length scale, and mm-hmm. then another, you know, with the unfolding. And because it seems like they have to be folded into a modular structure for some reason.
That's correct.
Right?
That's absolutely correct.
I mean, because it's a very mechanically unique architecture, this modular structure. And so, it's very interesting to hypothesize that maybe both those length scales contribute to the function of the protein.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of my take on this also. That mm-hmm. I think our paper sort of did to the discussion was it sort of shored up that, yeah, there's this alternate mechanism, and it's not unreasonable mm-hmm. that actually could play a role. But I think in order to make some progress in that direction, one really would have to understand more about how fibronectin is basically built into these fibrils.
Mm.
I mean, and how are these fibrils laterally connected? Because you could also argue that actually the strains in each fibronectin molecule may not be that large.
Yeah.
If the fibril overall is a fairly sort of loose network. So there could be a lot of slack taking up by basically distributing all these strains in these in relatively small strains per individual fibronectin molecule.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I guess, then that modular unfolding is maybe not even that necessary because the strains are not that large.
Mm. It's interesting.
But no, I think this is really an unsolved problem yet, how these fibrils really are formed and what's the lateral connectivity and all that.
From the fibronectin molecule,
yeah.
So that's not well known.
That's not well known, no.
Mm. That's interesting.
And I think that's also sort of the big leap which we have to make in our paper, because we go from a single molecule and measurements on a single molecule and then basically interpret a behavior which we observe in a fibril.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's maybe it's too far of a stretch potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Zauscher, could you talk a little bit about what were the difficulties you encountered in this experiment and also maybe compare it to single molecule force spectroscopy other using other molecules?
So if you maybe, Yi, are you also doing single molecule force spectroscopy?
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe we can go to Stefan and then Yi, and you can each like comment on what you think is the most difficult aspect of the of this kind of research.
Why don't we let Yi start?
I want to hear what you're down there in the trenches.
Yeah, I'm definitely down there in the trenches. And I think, I guess the most difficult part of this, and we've already kind of touched on this in the discussion, is that we hope that we're looking at what we think we're looking at, I think ultimately is the issue. And we look at things kind of secondarily. Unlike a microscope, you can't actually see what you're pulling. You hope that you're pulling a single molecule, and in my work, I try to pull a series of molecules apart. They bind, and then I try to rupture them to see what kind of forces are involved in their binding. And a lot in the same sense, here we're trying to pick up one molecule and stretch it. And so I think to have that kind of resolution and to have the confidence in that resolution is something that we have to sort of statistically tweak out and have confidence in our protocols that, you know, in our chemical adsorption and those kinds of things and preparing samples, that that's really what we're getting. So I think that's one of my biggest, I guess, difficulties.
Yeah, I think that's with nanotechnology in general, it's you know, you can't see it directly, you know, so it takes a leap of faith in many aspects, and a number of other of our guests have commented on that as well.
Several of you guys know what the trenches are all about.
And Stefan?
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is a really valid point that if we work on basically sub-diffraction limited stuff, it's often the AFM which we use to do an experiment, and then we use it in the same token to analyze what we actually did. I mean, it's sort of kind of odd.
Right.
That you would not have an alternate way of actually checking. And but I think the difficulty, I mean, clearly in this experiment, was also to get the constructs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't really speak to that, but it's not so easy to engineer all of these these different fibronectin constructs, because I guess it depends on the box you use and the conditions, and then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and then you have to purify them. And so this is a major effort.
Yeah, so I guess it definitely requires a very high biochemistry expertise and also close collaboration with biochemists to do that.
Unless you have a very large lab where you basically have all that to your disposal. But otherwise, I mean, we certainly in my lab, I could not just decide, oh, that's what I want to do. That would not be possible, essentially. Okay. So, but that's also the beauty about some of these collaborations, that synergistically one can actually produce new and interesting results. So, and the difficulty, aside from maybe these the constructs in the measurement itself, is clearly the calibration of the cantilevers. I mean, that is pretty routine, but still, despite the fact that it is routine, it is non-trivial. For just simply the fact, we spent a month on this, I think. If you measure the cantilever spring constant in air, and if you measure it in liquid, well, it's a material property, so it should be the same, but it doesn't come out to be the same.
Mm. And since it's linear related to the force, if you have a different spring constant, that'll give you a different force. And if you're trying to compare how you pulled this molecule with how someone else pulled this molecule, and you have different forces by a magnitude of 2 because your spring constant is off, then it's, you know, sheds kind of a doubt on if you're pulling the right molecules. And just in the scientific community, I think there's more and more sort of a consistency with, you know, how you do your calibration to make sure that the data is comparable.
Right. So I guess that if you're doing a series of experiments with the same cantilever, then, you know, you can compare them. But if you want to, like you said, compare with another group, and especially since the whole foundation of the paper is based on the magnitude of the forces, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So at least, I mean, we are very confident that clearly that, I mean, within our paper,
right,
are fairly consistent and comparable.
Right, so you can definitely compare, like, the GFP and the fibronectin, yeah.
Following our procedures, I would nearly guarantee that you come out with different values.
Okay.
I get the same distances, the same patterns, the same exact signature. But
right, but the absolute values.
The absolute values are different. And I think this is an interesting issue also. Often in papers, this is overstressed, I think, that people say, well, one has to really come down to the precise number.
Yeah.
And often this is maybe not so important. Maybe what's more important is the relative.
Right, the relative trends.
The relative values. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one just says, all right, it doesn't really matter whether it's 100 or 120 piconewtons. I mean, sometimes this may matter, but often it doesn't, as long as you compare it then to something which you measured in the same way.
Right.
Okay, another question that I had is, what do you think is the most exciting discovery reported in this paper? If you had to pick one or two, maybe.
Okay, well, I think the most exciting one was that GFP unfolds essentially at the same forces as fibronectin. Mm-hmm. That was something which we had hoped for to see, and I think it's certainly what this whole study showed. Uh-huh. And I think the other exciting thing which came out of this, at least for us, it was satisfying that we actually can do this type of work and right. do it thoroughly and I think quite nicely. So
was this the first time you worked on a protein construct?
This is the first time. I mean, we've worked even before, but it's not published. So This is the first really published
work on construct.
We have one out now on these cis transisomerization in proline in these elastin-like polypeptides, which is quite nice. Mm-hmm. So that's also a construct.
Okay, and what are some? What's the future of this work? Are you continuing with fibronectin? Are you continuing your collaboration with Harald Eriksson?
Yeah, we talked about this, and at the moment, I think in this particular venue, there's really not much more we can do at the moment. So on this specific project, we are not continuing, but we have talked on and off that we are interested in spectrin.
Uh-huh.
And actually, very early on, we wanted to look at spectrin, and then some of the first spectrin papers came out by the Gaup and Reef groups, and so that's cooled down a little bit. But I think Harald is actually still quite interested in it. And, in fact, he is, I think, working on some constructs where we essentially have to wait till he has a system to work with.
Mm-hmm. And what other single-molecule force spectroscopy are you working on currently?
So we work currently on these elastin-like polypeptides, and we work there on actually exploring hydrophobic hydration, it turns out. This was an accident that we found this, but we have a way now, we think, to look at the interaction of solvent with basically proteins. We can measure by force pulling differences in the hydrophobic hydration of proteins, mm-hmm. and that's quite exciting to me. And we are looking with Yi at basically receptor ligand interactions, which are also single molecule, but not they don't involve force pulling in the sense that we are interested in the elasticity. We're just interested in the unbinding forces and also the interaction forces.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And we have started a project where we're interested in tribology, and that's, I guess, a little bit in the direction you work with cartilage. Mm-hmm. We're interested in a glycoprotein lubricin, and nobody really has looked at the elasticity of these molecules, and it's probably quite important if they are implicated in lubrication in joints.
Right.
And so we have played around, and we built actually an AFM to do single molecule measurements specifically. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I would like to do, we haven't started, is to look at lubricin, which are basically block copolymers.
Right. Great. And so I guess we'll wrap it up. We can just go back to Yi. So Yi, are you graduating this year?
Well, we'll see.
Are you writing your thesis?
I'm still running some experiments and hope to start it on the writing. Yeah, that's a part of being in the trenches. You don't really know how long your trench is as you're digging it. I need help with someone to stand at the end with a stop sign.
And what's your plan for the future?
And then actually after that, I hope to go to medical school. Professor Ortiz has been instrumental in helping me get there, and I've been accepted. So.
Oh, you were accepted?
Yeah, I was. Actually, I sent a card, so I guess you haven't got that yet.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, so do you know where you're going?
Hopefully staying in the North Carolina area. Uh-huh. And if I don't finish this year, I can still go next year. So.
Uh-huh.
either at UNC or maybe here at Duke.
Boy, you're a masochist. So, you know, 6 years of PhD and then starting medical school.
I'm not an example to follow.
Yeah.
Don't do it this way.
So can you imagine a doctor with knowledge in single molecule force spectroscopy?
Yeah, that's just beyond my comprehension.
What field do you want to go into?
I want to work in women's health.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's great. I'm sure you'll be able to use single molecule force spectroscopy for that.
It'll help me relate to people.
Well, you'll be able to speak with scientists, you know, a lot better, I think, and researchers. Are you gonna go into medical research?
I'm not sure if I want to dive right back into the bench, but I think as far as clinical research, I'd want to be involved in something like that.
Right.
You know, now I need to tackle one hurdle at a time, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, my brother's an oncologist, and he always makes jokes about all the PhDs who come in and talk in a funny, strange language that all the doctors kind of, you know, don't understand. So
do you translate for him?
Yeah. But then vice versa, he says, you know, the PhDs don't understand anything about people in the clinic, so...
Hopefully I can
Hopefully you will bridge both. And now he's going to kill me that I said that on
online. He's just jabbing.
Yeah.
This is available on the internet.
Yeah, I know, you know, but I'm not a real doctor, you know, not like a medical doctor. So all right, well, thanks so much, Stefan, and thank you, Yi. Best of luck with your many years ahead of medical school.
Thank you.
That was great.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.